It was an incredible year in news. And in fact, we'd originally planned to do this feature, this talk back, yesterday, last night at this time. But as it turns out, we're talking about it today. Now, if we had done it last night, maybe the biggest news story of the year wouldn't have happened yet. And in Australia, one of the biggest news stories of the year will happen tomorrow. What an incredible year it was that saw a change of government in Australia, at least two premiers and one chief minister stepping down, knowing when to leave, when perhaps other federal leaders didn't take the hint. We saw APEC. An Australian came second in the Tour de France. Yet another gun massacre in the United States. Rupert Murdoch taking over the Wall Street Journal. And the fallout from the subprime mortgage disaster in the United States. They're just some of the many news stories that made news around the world and Australia this year. We will want your thoughts on the major stories of the year very soon, but before that, we are only too happy to welcome to the nightlife Stephen Main, media gadfly, online columnist, consumer or shareholder activist, founder of Crikey. Anything else I've left out, Stephen? Good evening and welcome.
Hi, Rod. Nice to be with you. And yes, an amazing year in news. Although, aren't they all, I guess?
Well, they are indeed, but some seem to be more incredible than others. It is amazing that maybe the biggest story of the year happened just last night.
Well, I think in international affairs that you're absolutely right, that the assassination of Benazir Bhutto and all that that will mean for Pakistan with the elections that were meant to be held on January 8 and this being probably Al-Qaeda's most prominent strike since September 11, I think. Well, I mean, obviously they've had a series of big hits over the years, Bali included, but I think that this is a huge blow. And what happens to Pakistan, the battle for Pakistan now, as it unfolds in the coming days, will, I think, be a dramatic and hard-to-beat international story in what's been a pretty busy year.
It was an unbelievable lead-up to this. I mean, of course, many people would have predicted it. Just the battle in getting Pakistan to the polls was a problem enough. There's no guarantee that this will happen. Some parties are already saying that they're going to pull out of the election campaign. So how can we even take the election seriously in Pakistan?
Well, that's the big debate. I mean, the Muslim League, led by Nawaz Sharif, another former prime minister who was running, is calling for a boycott. There are still those who are saying, you know, with a dictator sitting at the top in President Musharraf, the whole thing is flawed anyway. And then, of course, there's the sympathy vote potential for the Pakistan People's Party, which Benazir Bhutto was leading, that if they can get themselves organised and put up an alternative leader, and if the elections were held, then there's every chance that they might actually get a much bigger vote and could actually win the election if the election is held. So Musharraf's information minister at the moment is saying, yes, the elections will be held, but I mean, a lot of the big cities are in lockdown, there's sporadic reports of violence. It is an incredible situation for this to happen just, less than 2 weeks out. And as you know, the funeral procession is on right now as we speak in Lucarna. So, it's incredibly fluid situation. It's evolved over the past 24 hours.
As there was the lead-up to this, though, it seemed like George Bush and the US government and the allies in the war on terror really did not know which way to jump. They knew that Musharraf is a dangerous man, and yet it's better to have somebody like that in control of Pakistan than, in fact, chaos in Pakistan.
Well, I think that's right, and I mean, you look at the camps on the border with Pakistan and Afghanistan. That's where Osama bin Laden is said to have been sheltered. The battle for Pakistan, stopping Pakistan from falling into Muslim state, has been a key part of George Bush's strategy. Hence, propping up Musharraf, despite the fact that he seized control of Pakistan in a completely unacceptable and undemocratic coup. But it's been a marriage of convenience, and it's just been more and more difficult to hold together as he's been more dictatorial and as more and more radicalism has appeared in Pakistan. And then the return home of Benazir Bhutto after 8 years away, the whole elections which the US was supporting, but then there's been whole criticisms about the elections and various people calling for them to be boycotted. And of course, Benazir Bhutto herself taking pretty substantial risks. I mean, crisscrossing the country and appearing in rallies. Some would say tempting fate. And then for Al-Qaeda to claim the scalp like this at this point in time is, it's just an incredibly volatile stunning situation.
Yeah. Elsewhere, there were easier transitions of power. In Australia, we had Peter Beattie stepping down for Anna Bligh. We had Steve Brack stepping down for John Brumby. We had Tony Blair in the UK stepping down for Gordon Brown. And we had in Australia, John Howard stepping down for Kevin Rudd. I mean, it seems as though the federal transition was as seamless as any of the state ones.
Well, it was. I mean, John Howard himself made the comment that we have a wonderful democracy where this can happen so politely and without any violence. And, I mean, we do take it for granted in Australia, but, we haven't really had any political violence in Australia. I mean, there were obviously a few protests around the constitutional crisis in 1975, but overall, we've had a long tradition of peaceful transitions of power. And, yes, it was definitely the year for transitions of power. The surprise at the departure of Steve Brax in July, I mean, it was a real surprise. He absolutely came from nowhere. Peter Beattie, you know, a right-wing leader handing over to a left faction leader in Anna Bligh, and Queensland's first female premier was absolutely seamless, and she's travelling along just fine in the polls, as is John Brumby. And I think the real lesson for John Howard was the way that Gordon Brown has picked up the transition from Tony Blair and gone from being a relatively unpopular chancellor, the treasurer equivalent, to a far more popular prime minister who's had a big lift in the polls. And obviously that's the lesson for Australia, that that's what John Howard should have done, and the way he got thrown out and created history being the first Prime Minister since Stanley Bruce in 1929 to lose his seat. Obviously, in the context of Australia, that was the story of the year. From Maxine McHugh to the unprecedented history of having wall-to-wall Labor governments, and I don't think again you're going to see a Conservative government take on working people in their workplaces and the laws around industrial relations in such a bold and brazen way, and then coming up against a Labor Party and a union movement that ran, I think you've got to say, with Kevin Rudd, a pretty flawless campaign.
Yes, in fact, the union movement and the work choices, or their battle against work choices, was going on all year, long before the election campaign began. Kevin Rudd didn't have to strike a blow in the campaign because the union movement were doing it for him.
Well, when you spend $28 million in advertising as a union movement, that's a pretty powerful sort of interest group, I think you could say. And Kevin Rudd is no particular friend of the unions, and I think in a way, during the campaign, was actually moving to distance himself from the union movement with John Howard's claims about 70% of the opposition front benches being from unions. But Kevin Rudd managed to walk that beautiful line of tapping into the working family question on rising prices and the whole sort of security in the workplace, and John Howard basically breaking his promise to keep Australians comfortable and relaxed by really introducing what was seen to be fairly radical industrial relations laws. And Kevin Rudd, I mean, a lot of people thought he was a bit a bit nerdy and a bit of an unknown quantity, but he ran a really flawless campaign. I mean, what was the worst thing he did over the course of his campaign? I think there were no serious blunders. He snookered Howard beautifully with the fiscal responsibility, won the debate. Most of his shadows won their debates against their opposition ministers. And, just a very disciplined campaign. And it hit the ground running. I mean, the guy's a workaholic. He's absolutely, he's been to Iraq, he's been to Bali, he's been absolutely flat out. And I think most people are saying, a lot of liberals I speak to, this new bloke doesn't seem too bad, he's doing okay. So, an amazingly peaceful transition of power and a new guy who's just looking comfortable in the job already.
Three major issues when it came to the economy. I suppose interest rates is one, put that to one side. There's the subprime crisis in the United States, which the bombs that were over there exploded over in Australia as well. The Qantas takeover bid was an absolute shambles. And then there's the Australian dollar, which went from strength to strength and then fell back a bit.
Yeah, look, it was a very interesting year for business. I mean, private equiteers attempting to spend $11 billion privatising Australia's most iconic brand, Qantas. And they got very, very close in early May when the bid fell over. But the shareholders revolted against the board and ended up being the chairman and James Packer, who was a supporter of the chairman on the board, who ended up quitting the board, and Qantas has remained independent. But that was almost, I think you could call it, the peak of the easy debt days, where private equity firms could just rustle up, $10 billion of debt just like that. Banks were lending money to anyone, and private equity bids were happening all over the place. And now, with the whole subprime meltdown, it's really difficult for anyone to raise a loan unless you're a real blue chip AAA type of credit risk. And we've seen the American subprime market potentially cost about $400 to $500 billion Australian dollars in losses. And the phenomenon of globalisation, where these losses are not just an issue for Americans or American banks, but the debt securities have been wrapped up and parceled off all over the world. The Chinese government have dropped $20 or $30 billion. Everyone's losing money left, right and centre, plugging this $400 billion hole. And it's caused this whole liquidity crisis, this whole credit market crisis, which is just popping up, every other day. There's a story of a French bank getting into trouble, German state government losing billions, and then Centro Property Group, Australia's second biggest owner of shopping centres, suddenly $5 billion of Australian superannuation funds wiped out in one day, when they reveal they can't roll over $18 billion of debt because of credit markets all being choked up. So, yes, it's been, the last 6 months of the year, the subprime crash has been a phenomenal global business story. And I guess the other interesting comparison is the rise of China, and the whole question of whether Australia can continue to prosper in spite of American troubles because of the rise of China and the mining boom.
And that's where all the money is being made in Australia at the moment. And as you say, we'll see whether that continues. But in Western Australia, another name that kept coming up, I should say, like a bad penny, was Brian Burke. Unbelievably, when he left the premiership in disgrace so many years ago, I don't know, people probably thought he would have gone quietly. That's not the case. He was still coming up this year.
Yeah, that's right. All these years later, he was revealed by the Triple C inquiry in WA to have had enormous power and influence, with ministers being having special phones given to him by Brian Burke, and just leaking like sieves on sensitive cabinet deliberations, and him basically being able to make a lot of money, being the phenomenal string puller in WA. And we've seen an anti-corruption body with extraordinary powers set up and basically laid all this chapter and verse out in the public eye about what had been going on. And it caused all sorts of rockets to go off. Even, I think, Kevin Rudd, one of his biggest wobbles of the year was his big dinner with Brian Burke in Perth, which Peter Costello rubbished him in the Parliament about quite effectively. And, of course, you had Senator Ian Campbell resigning from the Howard Ministry because he'd had a meeting with Brian Burke. So, the whole Brian Burke and the pervasive influence that he has in WA, you thought would have been dead and buried, more than a decade ago. But I think it's only been finished off by all the publicity around this Triple C inquiry over the last, 3 or 4 months.
A couple of other business stories we should look at. One is Rupert Murdoch buying Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal. When you think there are three major, most influential newspapers in the world, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times and the Times of London, and Rupert owns two of them.
Yeah, look, he's done phenomenally well for a 23-year-old, I think he was, when he took over his father's very small empire, as it was back in October 1952. And it's been a 55-year journey where he's put together the most powerful media empire in the world, and I think it is fair to say it's been his crowning glory to buy Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal in a deal that only closed a couple of weeks ago. But there's actually an interesting little connection to this story today, and that is the question of another West Australian called Andrew Forrest, who is the controlling shareholder in Fortescue Metals. Now, today, for the first time, Andrew Forrest's shareholding in Fortescue Metals has gone past the value of Rupert Murdoch's shareholding in News Corp. So Rupert's always been the richest Australian, and he is about to surrender that mantle to Andrew Forrest, who's still in his 40s. He's a relatively young man. But he's ridden the iron ore boom, and the share price was up another 15% today. Fortescue Metals, and his shareholding is now worth $8.66 billion, whereas at the close of trade today, Rupert Murdoch's stake in News Corp is $8.5 billion. So Rupert is still the man in terms of Australians, but he might no longer be the richest Australian if the mining boom and Andrew Forrest and Fortescue Metals continues to go north on the back of Chinese demand.
Now, Andrew Forrest is now Australia's richest man.
Well, based on the shareholding valuations tonight, he has the most valuable individual holding in any listed company on the Australian Stock Exchange. So his stake, his 36% stake in Fortescue, is tonight worth $8.66 billion. And Rupert's been sold off a few shares recently in News Corp, and News Corp shares have been a bit weak because of the whole US dollar falling and the US economy being a bit slower. So whilst Rupert has bought the trophy asset of, you know, Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal, his share price has actually been going south a bit this year, whereas Andrew Forrest and Fortescue Metals, their share price is up tenfold over the years. Over the year, it's been an incredible rise. And, you know, the company itself is now worth, you know, pushing $23, $24 billion. And it doesn't even produce a ton of iron ore yet. So it really does summarise this whole resources boom, that a company which is simply developing its iron ore mines in WA, trying to break the traditional stranglehold that BHP and Rio Tinto have had over iron ore industry in Australia. This company, which is going to do its first shipment in May, the controlling shareholder, the founder, is now worth $8.66 billion on paper. And the other great irony and the other amazing business story in recent weeks has been that BHP is trying to buy Rio Tinto at the moment to create a $400 billion company, which would be one of the six or seven biggest companies in the world. So little old Australia, coming out of this mining boom, might yet have one of the top companies in the world. And, yeah, it just shows you how, despite all the problems in the US with subprime, et cetera, the rise and rise of China, literally, you know, hundreds of millions of Chinese are urbanising, moving to the coast and to the cities, and all the building and development that's going around that is, you know, causing some seismic shifts in the way the world economy works.
Yeah, James Packer had a fair year, though. He got married. He'd be happy about that, wouldn't he?
Well, James had a good year. He got married, and he also walked away from the media to a large degree. He sold another 25% stake in Channel 9 and his traditional magazine empire. And he went hurtling down the casino road, buying up casinos in Canada, moving on Russian casino interests, and big spending billions in Macau building casinos, and separating his PBL company into a separate casino entity called Crown, and the sort of rats and mice residual media interests. And interestingly, in terms of the $8 billion Packer family fortune, $3.5 billion of that is tied up in the casino business, and only $1.1 billion of that fortune is now tied up in the listed media assets that he's got. So it's been a good year, but his mate Andrew Forrest has arguably gone past him just in the last few days as the richest Australian resident person, because Rupert's based over in New York. And yes, he did get married, though, and he's rushing down the casino path. So he's a good year. I mean, you know, when you're doing the sort of deals that James Packer's doing, spending billions building a global casino empire, you know, you're still noteworthy, I think it's fair to say, Rod.
It's a really fascinating thing, though, with James Packer, that not long after his father died, he divested himself of what his father's favourite thing was, which was Channel 9, and really threw himself completely into something that his father... Well, obviously his father loved casinos, but as a player, not necessarily as an owner.
And that is a very interesting question. I went to the last PBL AGM at Crown Casino and said, look, you know, casinos are an awful way to make a buck, James. It's really disappointing you're getting out of the media and you're going into casinos. And he's never really answered the question as to why, what is his passion for casinos. And I don't know, I was having a chat to someone who's followed him closely over the years recently, whose theory was as follows, that James knows exactly how much his father lost playing casinos. Mm. And he's never been a player himself. He's more just he knows how profitable they can be from having clients such as his father. And this person's theory was that they think James wants to show his father that he was a mug for playing casinos from the wrong side of the table, and he was going to show him how to make a fortune actually being on the right side of the table, being the house in a global casino business. And that's what he's doing. So the Australians don't produce that many internationally known business empires. Obviously, there's Rupert Murdoch at News Corp, and there's Frank Lowy at Westfield, which is the world's biggest shopping centre empire. But James Packer really does look like he's trying to put together one of the world's biggest casino empires, and something that maybe his father would have been proud of if he'd still been around to see it being developed.
McCary Packer had a long-standing dislike of the regulation of TV and media in Australia. You'd be mad to stick around. It doesn't make the money that casinos do, really. I mean, casinos are just licenses to print money.
Well, they are, but I mean, I've spoken to people who've had conversations with James Packer who say that the reason he still wants to have a foothold in the likes of Channel 9 is the political power it gives you. I mean, there's always been this whole status that comes from being a media owner. And I think since James has sold down out of ACP and Channel 9, that his aura in Australia, in Australian politics, has diminished somewhat. He's still in there to some degree with 25%, but it is reduced. He doesn't control the businesses anymore. And look, he's just making what many think is a smart business decision. That Channel 9, you know, free-to-air ultimately is going to be cannibalised by things like fast broadband in everyone's home and, you know, and hundreds of other channels on pay TV, these things. It's a declining medium. Same with magazines. It's a declining medium. And so he's getting out. He's still concentrating. He's still got his investments in things like Seek.com and the online classifieds business, and he's got 25% of Foxtel, so he's got a few other media plays out there. But I think from his point of view, it's just, I'll sell out of the low-growth media assets. I won't be sentimental about it, even though my father was a bit more sentimental. I'll take the big bucks from private equity, and I'll plough it into casinos, which is an interesting way for Australia's, or formerly Australia's richest man to go.
We should always remember his father wasn't all that sentimental. He did sell Channel 9 at one point. 1-300-800-222, 1-300-800-222. You're on The Nightlife with Rod Quinn. Our guest is Stephen Mayne. If you'd like to talk about any of the issues we've discussed, or maybe bring up a news issue or news story yourself, we'd love to talk to you. 1-300-800-222. With sport, in some ways this year, it was very much as before. Roger Federer dominated, Tiger Woods dominated, Australia dominated in cricket in one of the most fast-score World Cup finals of all time. Australia won in the pitch dark. But then elsewhere, we had Geelong ending the 44-year drought to win the AFL. Melbourne, in fact, Geelong and Melbourne in the Rugby League, very similar, that they had been dominant throughout the year and they inevitably won their grand finals. And both league and AFL were beset by drugs scandals. Ben Cousins and Andrew Johns.
I think you've summarised the world in sport very well then, Rod. For mine, I think Geelong winning the AFL was the big story. I mean, a 44-year drought, the fact that the six in a row had been run by interstate teams, and Melbourne was the traditional home of the AFL. And for them to smash Port Adelaide by a record 119 points in the final, and the whole sort of Gary Ablett Senior, Gary Ablett Junior story as well, also picking up Jimmy Bartel, picking up the Brownlow. I think that was, domestically at least, the story of the year. And I think you also should remember that Shane Warne only retired
this year
at the end of the 5-0 Ashes wipeout in Sydney, 11 months ago. And that is, I think, is still a big moment in sport for the year. The retirement of, what many would argue is the greatest bowler of all time. And the fact that the Australians have lost, Langer, Glenn McGrath and Warne, and have gone on to still dominate cricket, to still win their third straight World Cup in the West Indies over Sri Lanka, absolutely flogging Sri Lanka in the final, with Gilchrist and Hayden putting on 172 for the opening stand. And look what they're doing to the Indians at the moment. So the fact that we've lost the greatest in Warney, and he's bowed out with the record, or which he's now subsequently lost, of course, to Murali. And we've continued to dominate, I think, was also a pretty big story this year in sport.
And I thought the funniest, or one of the funniest stories in sport this year, was that Shane Warne, in a newspaper column, recently said Australia had become arrogant at cricket. And I thought, you know what, since you retired, they've played about three tests since Shane Warne retired, and obviously the arrogance has crept in since Shane's retirement.
Well, I think the thing is that Warney now has to make controversial statements for a living in his media columns, so I think he's egging it up a little bit. He's always a larger than life character. I mean, he's having a bit of a feud with Adam Gilchrist at the moment, and Gareth Evans, I think it was, who coined the phrase irrelevance deprivation syndrome, and I think maybe Warney's suffered a bit of that. So, it is interesting that he's still playing a bit part on the sidelines there. And of course, his private life continues to be a bit of a soap opera, you know, with regular mentions in the women's magazines for his various misdemeanors. So Warney, same old, controversial, colourful bloke, but at the end of the day, a legendary leg spin bowler. And his departure after that drubbing in Sydney was, I think, a big moment in world sport this year.
Ben Cousins and Andrew Johns. Differences and yet similarities with those two. Ben Cousins and Andrew Johns both took illegal drugs, we are told, during their playing careers. One fessed up and came clean, and the other one, well, is referred to as a disgraced sporting star, and that's Ben Cousins. What's the future for Ben Cousins, and why was it that Andrew Johns was almost... he was treated with far more respect, I think, than Ben Cousins.
Well, I think that there's a degree of community understanding on depression issues in Australia. I think Australian communities become quite mature in the way they deal with that. And Andrew Johns just coming out point blank and saying that, yes, he had addiction. Yes, he played Russian roulette with the authorities and the drug testers for many, many years. And he had been suffering from depression. And he just came out and just did it on television like that. It was just a pretty upfront way of doing it, whereas Ben Cousins was just constantly, the image of Ben Cousins was of him running from the media, of him running from the police, of him running from the cameras at LA Airport, of him just dodging and weaving. I mean, he's a great dodger and weaver on the footy field, but he promised he'd fix himself, and then he goes off and gets involved in another bender, and just had so many warnings from the West Coast Eagles, and eventually everyone just had to give him the flick. The AFL had to insist on a ban, that West Coast Eagles had to sack him, and despite continually promising to do something about it, he still seems to be someone who was battling an addiction and was never really upfront about it in a decent way. So I think you are right, Rod, that the contrast with the sympathy and the way that each of those two stars, arguably two of the biggest players in their leagues, the way they treated the situation differently was noteworthy this year.
Both never tested positive to drugs either, which is interesting. Let's talk to Murray in Canberra. G'day, Murray.
Oh, good evening, Rod. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Got Stephen Mayne with us as well.
Oh, hello, Stephen.
Hi, Murray.
Rod, I've got nominations both for the general current affairs and one specifically for sport. I think in general current affairs, the major acts in the six-year-long saga that was the David Hicks issue all emerged in 2007, and if it wasn't occupying the front pages of the newspapers, it was only it was on page two or three, really, on every month this year, how it played out in court, how it played out in the United States with high court actions testing the validity of what was going on with Guantanamo Bay, and then David Hicks, the charges finally being laid against David Hicks, and then him and his defence counsel, Major Michael Murray and the other people, defending him and the plea bargaining and getting back to Australia, and of course... it's not over yet. Tomorrow he gets released from Yatika Prison in Adelaide. So that's still going to... that David Hicks has occupied the entire year, I think, from beginning to end.
Stephen, the way that, in a way, the Prime Minister sort of neutralised that as an election campaign issue, we never heard the name David Hicks mentioned in the campaign, did we?
Well, that's right. I mean, there was never going to be huge votes in it or sympathy, and Labor wasn't going to come out and start mentioning David Hicks. He was just part of the narrative of the government being in lockstep with George Bush and the Bush administration and being tough on, you know, national security issues. And he was part of that narrative. And after 6 years, obviously, the civil rights elements of it and the bungling of the way the Americans had handled the case became a bit of an issue for the government going into an election year, and I think they made a conscious decision to try and neutralise it. So I think that there was pressure brought to bear to the authorities in the US, and then I think many were surprised that David Hicks did eventually plead guilty to supporting terrorism. Basically, it was a plea bargain, and then yes, the issue was neutralised, and the government deliberately set out to neutralise it. And tomorrow, well, the press reports and David Hicks's father Terry have been saying that there'll be an apology read out by David Hicks's lawyer. There's all sorts of, you know, control orders, and he's got to report to police, and he can't profit from selling his story to the media. So I think he just wants to go and get a job and go to maybe possibly go to university. So you'll see a massive media press pack out there tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock after he comes out. You'll see a statement from his lawyer apologising sincerely and in a sweeping way. And then I think David Hicks is going to attempt to disappear off the... Off the media scene.
Well, I mean, you think at the moment it might be impossible, but then when was the last time we ever heard of Monica Lewinsky, really? I mean, she was on the front page of every newspaper, every bulletin around the world, and yet she's managed to kind of disappear into anonymity. So I hope David Hicks can do that as well. Murray, you've got a sports story for us as well.
Yes, right. For mine, there was only one truly great sports story of the year, and that was the fairy tale-like emergence of Iraq to win the... Asian Soccer Championship this year. You know, it captured, I think, everybody's imagination. You know, from, you know, these guys from a war-torn country, hardly had ever trained together or seen each other, and got together in the three host countries in Asia, and just played the pants off every opposition they met, and put Australia to shame in the group stage, and went on to win it against. The Saudis, I think, and it just captured everybody's imagination, and it was just truly a wonderful story, I thought.
Okay.
I would have nominated Cadel Evans.
He's got to win it
in the Tour de France this year, but I'm fully confident he can go one better next year, 2008. So I'll be nominating that. At the end of 2008, I'll be nominating Cadel Evans for winning the Tour de France.
Thank you very much, Murray. Yes, Stephen, you know, the way that the Iraqi soccer team used to train, when I think it was at Kusay or Uday, one of Saddam Hussein's sons was in charge of them, I think they probably would have enjoyed their training a hell of a lot more. They were, you know, in the old days, if they didn't win, they were executed.
Well, that's right. They're executions all around. So, I think maybe they've liberated from not having threat of death hanging over a poor performance. But, look, it was a great story. And I mean, I think the Australian performance was a bit disappointing after all the excitement of the World Cup. But if anyone was going to win it, then I think Murray's sentiments are right, that it was nice to see the fairy tale story of the Iraqis taking out the Asian Cup.
1-300-800-222. Did you have a great news story this year? We'd like to hear from you. 1-300-800-222. Tristan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Do you reckon the emergence of Kevin Rudd?
Yeah, I like how the Australian Labor Party got in power this year, because, you know, like the Liberals have been in power just far too long, and I think, you know, from what I said to Tony, you know, before the election, that they would do very well and they would get in, and I was right about that.
Well, it wasn't much of a... I've got to say, I mean, well done, but Stephen, everyone predicted it, didn't they? Very few people thought the Liberals had a chance, and of course they were proved right.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the polls were saying it all year, but we'd also seen John Howard come back spectacularly in 2001 and 2004 when he was behind Beazley and Latham respectively. So I think that a lot of people sort of saw John Howard as the Energizer Bunny and were sort of, you know, wondering if he'd ever be dealt with, that he was the man who could just seemingly confound the critics every time. So a lot of, you know, Paul Keating's sentiment of, you know, Oh, it was just a relief when he lost, you know. I just, you know, I felt like I'd been just washed down with a hose, and thank goodness for that. So I think, but if you look at how it actually happened, that, you know, Mark Latham was a bit of an aberration for Labor, and Labor got themselves a decent leader, and he presented well, and I think few people realised how diligently Kevin Rudd would court the media, and that he built himself up completely away from the traditional sort of union factions that you see in the Labor Party. You know, he did the whole Sunrise thing.
Yeah. I don't think that can be underestimated. That I heard somebody, maybe it was on Insiders or someone somewhere else, saying, you know, no one knows who Kevin Rudd is. And I thought, no, I'd say the press gallery think they, that the public don't, because the press gallery don't watch Sunrise. But a hell of a lot of Australians do watch Sunrise, and they saw a bloke that they liked and they thought they could trust.
Well, I think that's true, although he is still the most unknown, or you know, least known new Prime Minister we've had. I mean, you have, you know, Hawke was in the eye for a long time. Keating was the Treasurer for many years. John Howard was the Treasurer. So I think that that comment is still correct. This is a guy who only got into the Parliament, I think, in 1998. But since he did get into the Parliament, I mean, all the times he appeared in the media on the AWB scandal as the Foreign Affairs Spoken, but he was indefatigable. Mm. He was just everywhere. He would spend hours every day dealing with the media and just getting his message out. And we all know in politics, you know, silence is death. It's all about visibility. And he basically made himself incredibly visible. And then when he finally persuaded his comrades to give him a job, and don't forget that they'd chosen others over him a couple of times before, that he had made noises about running and then yeah. pulled out because he was going to get an embarrassingly low vote. Finally, when Beazley fell over, he teamed up with one of his rivals, Julia Gillard, and then got the numbers. And then I think even his harshest critics, even Mark Latham, who was a, you know, used to call him knucklehead and these things, I think would have to admit that he was a very polished performer, and he kept on message very, very, in a very disciplined manner. And the fact that John Howard lost his seat, you know, I think the comment from Tristan is right, that Kevin Rudd was, you know, the story of the year. He and he, you know, he alone took Labor to this incredible victory, and he now has more power, I would argue, than any Labor Prime Minister in history. And the way he went out and just chose his front bench, and the way he's been so hard working, you know, calling the Premier's conferences before Christmas, shows that he's very energetic, and he's going to seriously call the shots and use that power which he's earned from such an emphatic victory over, you know, such a dominant Prime Minister in John Howard.
But Ray says not all the members of the new government have power. G'day, Ray.
How are you this evening?
Very well. You reckon Peter Garrett's been gagged?
Oh, well, obvious, mate. He's not allowed to answer any questions in the House of Representatives, is he? You know, like they said to him, you know, like he might make policy and all the rest of it, but he's not allowed to actually answer any questions. And I just think it's a typical continuation of the suppression of information that's going along. To Stephen Mayne, may I say, I think you handled yourself really well with the Glenn Milne incident.
that was last year, I think.
Yeah, I know it was last year, but maybe you shouldn't mix his Merlot with his medication. But I honestly think that Peter Garrett has been gagged, just because if you have a look at the history of Pete Garrett since, like, the days of Midnight Oil, he's very much left-wing, and he's very much in favour of the environment. And I must admit, I was very, very surprised when they actually made that announcement, you know, sort of what's the point of being the environment minister when you're not allowed to answer questions
in Parliament.
Question time in Parliament.
I mean, Stephen, what's the story on that, behind that?
Well, I think that it is true to say that Peter Garrett was, you know, obviously a left-wing activist, and that Kevin Rudd is a right-wing conservative within the broad church that is Labor. I think that Peter Garrett has been dealt a pretty unfair hand. Like, he, you know, he makes a joke to a shock jock in Steve Price in the Chairman's Lounge, at the Qantas Chairman's Lounge, and this confidence gets blurted out, and then it's painted as a gaffe when Garrett and the third party who watched it said it was just a joke. And his other so-called gaffe was suggesting that Australia might make unilateral commitments to reduce you know, emissions conditions in the context of developing countries not having to sign up to similarly stringent commitments going forward. And then that was a little bit nuanced as well. It wasn't just a clear-cut case of him just coming out and point-blank saying it. And then he got tarred with this whole gaffe-prone Garrett. Mm. And then I think that, Kevin Rudd has really sort of hemmed him in by saying that Wayne Swan's got to answer the climate change questions in the House of Representatives. And if I was Peter Garrett, I'd be pretty unhappy. But then again, he's sitting inside a Labor cabinet. He is the Environment Minister. He is ticking off things like, the pulp mill. He was in Bali. So I think that he'll just say, well, I'm copying a bit of flack. That's the perception out there, but at least I do have a seat at the table after, 20 years as someone who was an outsider, often mouthing slogans and lyrics, but not really having an impact on the process. And he's just going to say, I'm going to work through the Labor Party processes, see if I can achieve some change. Being in government with this government will be better than what John Howard was doing, and so incrementally, anything I can achieve for the environment from this position we're in now is an improvement. And yeah, I'm going to have to cop some flak. I won't get everything I want, but at least I'm supping on the power here.
Mm. Helen, good evening, Helen.
Good evening, gentlemen. I think the high point for me, pardon me, was Maxine McHugh. Defeating and taking the seat of Bennelong from the Prime Minister, John Howard.
Why was that?
Well, I think John Howard was full of hubris, really. He believed in his own power. And we had all those...
Well, he had a hell of a lot of it, I'll say that.
Oh, we had those scare campaigns with the Tampa and the other thing, and poor old Beazley. And Howard was just coasting along and ruling like a presidential person. And, gagging the people, apart from that coterie he had around him, who could speak on anything. But I think he'll go down in history for what he deserves as a second Prime Minister to lose his seat.
Funny that no one remembers who beat Stanley and Bruce. Or the fact that Bruce actually won his seat back 3 years later. No one actually remembers that. Thanks, Helen. Stephen, why didn't the Prime Minister go when it was seemingly obvious to everybody that the election may have been lost? And not only that, he was watching seamless transitions in the state, starting with Bob Carr, and there was all this talk that maybe he would lose his own seat. Why did he stick around? Also, when cabinet members were prepared, possibly, or they were all thinking he should go, but no one was prepared to say it to him.
Well, I think Peter Costello's father-in-law, Peter Coleman, described it as John Howard being a bit of an egomaniac, and I think that it was a case of hubris. And I think Alexander Downer's comments after the election were also quite telling, where he said that, the Costello supporters were being, frankly, quite rude, and they were being impatient, and they were being disloyal. And I think that, within the party, there wasn't, great support for Costello. There was just a recognition that they were in massive trouble in the polls, and the whole time factor and work choices and these things were working against them. And it wasn't an emphatic view that Peter Costello would necessarily do a whole lot better. And
the Prime Minister should have looked at Bob Hawke, who thought he was the only person who could lead Labor to victory in the 93 election, and he was hanging on, and then he was eventually overthrown by Paul Keating, and Paul Keating went on to win. That should have been a sign to the Prime Minister, to John Howard, to say, you know what, I'm not just the only person who can win this election.
Well, I think that's a good point, but history shows that whether it's sport, whether it's Tony Lockett attempting a comeback that he shouldn't have, it's just human nature. If you've got a great job, if you're on a good thing, you stick with it as long as you can. And, John Howard is just like Margaret Thatcher and like so many others before who just tried to stick around for too long. And I think that in mentioning Bennelong and Maxine McHugh, I thought Robert Ray's comment was very interesting, that Maxine McHugh could have taken a safe seat and she'd have owed the Labor Party for the rest of her life. Instead, now, she took on a marginal seat. She's knocked off the Prime Minister. She's a Labor hero for the rest of her life, and the Labor Party owes her for the rest of her career. And I think that was, you know, her decision to take that seat, it just energised the whole Labor campaign, that they were able to attract a quality candidate who is widely sort of admired, just for being a very personable and well-meaning person. And the fact that she took on such a supposedly difficult seat and then campaigned so well, you know, door-knocking 8,000 houses and not being the celebrity media tart. Like, she wasn't out there doing sound bites in the media. She ran a grassroots community campaign. And the great irony, I think, in the end, was that John Howard, the man who made some anti-Asian immigration comments back in the 1980s, was defeated, I think, by what many people regarded as the large Chinese, Korean, and also Indian community. And there were 1,600 Indians in Bennelong, and not many of them were happy with the way Dr. Muhammad Hanif was treated by the Howard government earlier in the year. That was also, I think, one of the big stories of the year. It actually, I think, won the Gold Walkley this year, the coverage of Dr. Hanif. And that whole saga all played in the end to contributing to John Howard's defeat in his own seat.
Bennelong being the, I think, in of the federal House of Representatives seats, the seat with the second highest number of people born in China or Hong Kong. So obviously that Asian influence is huge. Adam would like to mention what I think is probably the biggest sports story of the year, Adam.
Yes, good evening, Rod and Stephen. And a good friend of mine is a horse trainer based in Caulfield, and during the equine flu outbreak, I was discussing the chance of the Melbourne Cup and the possibility of running or not, and he gave me two percentages. The first percentage, 20% of it running, chance of it running, and the next one a little bit later, 30%. But how they got over the line was just amazing. But almost the story of the year.
I still think the equine influenza outbreak and the devastating influence, impact on racing in New South Wales and Queensland and elsewhere. That was the biggest sports story of the year. We should have mentioned it. And the fact that most, if not all, of the major Sydney races of the year were wiped out is massively important.
Yes.
Stephen?
Well, my trainer's friend's father was Clary Connors in Sydney, and he's come back with a vengeance. He said every race meeting just subsequent to coming back from the equine flu, he's had a winner. So he's found a key to new life after equine.
Battling trainer Clary Connors. Yes, Stephen?
Well, it was almost the biggest non-sports story of the year because of the amount of sport that it wiped out. I mean, this was a serious news story, almost, if you like, that wiped out, you know, a good portion of a very important industry. And I think a lot of Australians realised how big the racing industry is in terms of employment and activity and across Australia. And I agree that it was quite amazing that the Melbourne Cup got up, and you know, Lloyd Williams was able, as the owner of the winner, was able to get up for his third win. But yeah, poor old New South Wales in particular for the serious knocks that were laid out by that equine flu. It was quite devastating.
When you see the effect on caterers and on hat makers, on milliners in particular, and on dressmakers and people who sell women's clothes, it's just a massive dent into so many industries. It's one of the biggest industries in Australia, the racing industry, and just everyone connected with it was so appalling what happened in New South Wales and Queensland. Nigel, good evening.
Oh, yeah, not Maxine McHugh, but I could never understand Margaret Jackson. I'm a sentimental Qantas shareholder. Both Stephen Mayne and Margaret Jackson worked for Jeff Kennett, I understand, and so maybe he can explain who she was working for, Airline Partners Australia or us.
That's a very interesting question. Nigel, Stephen?
Well, look, Margaret didn't work for Jeff Kennett. She was got a couple of her first big appointments from Jeff Kennett. But look, I agree that I think it was quite an amazing situation that you had Margaret Jackson chair of Qantas suggesting that her questioning the mental capacities of her shareholders. Yeah, for not appreciating that if the $5.45 takeover bid failed, that the share price would tank and go south. Now, what was really incredible about this was that the bid closed in early May, and the profit forecast that the directors had in the market at the time was for a profit of $942 million for the 2006-07 financial year. They actually came in with $1,079 million. So here you had a board of directors 10 months into a financial year urging their shareholders to sell based on a profit forecast that was 130 million light. And frankly, I'm amazed they haven't yet copped a class action. I mean, I'm one of the shareholders, like many others, who sold out around the 520, 530 mark in March, April, thinking, well, the board says the shares are going to tank. The board says this is a great offer. And of course, the shares are now back up pushing $6. And I think it's appropriate that Margaret Jackson did retire at the Qantas AGM in Melbourne in November. And this was an amazing saga. And I think a lot of boards look at what happened with Qantas and say that is not how you conduct a takeover, where you have, you know, the chairman and the CEO doing sort of loving embraces almost at press conferences, celebrating this private takeover, which would have massively enriched the management. So the management, Jeff Dixon, and they had huge conflicts of interest in this whole process, and the board seemingly forgot that they were working for the shareholders.
Yes.
and recommended a bid that was decidedly light and was based on a profit forecast that was dreadfully inaccurate.
Mm. Thank you very much. And finally, Warren. G'day, Warren.
G'day, mate. How are you?
Fine, thanks. You've got something quick for us?
Yeah, mate. I thought the fact that the Vietnam veterans never gave up. They brought back the remains
of
the digs in 40 years.
Okay, that's a big story as well, Stephen. I mean, again, we should never forget that these blokes should be brought home. And, in fact, it's fairly recent in Australia's wars that bodies are brought home, that diggers are brought home.
That's right. Look, it doesn't. It used to not happen nearly as much as it should have. So I agree that was quite a symbolic and important move. And another question on the sort of heritage and their wars story. It was a lovely story during the year about the rats of Tobruk House in Melbourne, which said the diggers were too old and tired and didn't have the funds, and they were going to sell it. And they told this to the 7:30 report, and then a couple of bidders saw this the next day, and they bid in the auction, and a wealthy trucking magnate spent, like, $1.7 million buying Rats of Tobruk House in Melbourne so that the rats could continue to use it. So he didn't want to develop it or sell it. He just wanted for the boys to continue coming in and reflecting back on their history. So that was another good gesture showing how important it is to do the right thing in terms of our veterans in various different wars.
Stephen, we've missed out on APEC, which, well, it was always going to be, well, it ended up being, I suppose, smaller than it was going to be. And it was one of the reasons John Howard hung on, I think, was to parade with world leaders. And in fact, hanging on that long and then the election coming straight after it meant that he couldn't leave, and that may have been his downfall. There was the shootings in Virginia Tech in the United States, yet another massacre, where we ask, why can't the Americans get it? Why don't they understand that guns are the problem? They always come up with some other excuse, don't they?
Oh, I think you're right. That John Howard's one of his great achievements was gun control measures, and I think the Chaser stunt was the most memorable thing out of APEC, probably followed by Kevin Rudd's Mandarin performance.
All right, Stephen Mayne, thank you so much for your time tonight, and I hope 2007 is a good year. 2008, I should say, as well, is as news-filled year for you as well.
Thanks, Rod. It's a great pleasure.